I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. It's bird news this morning with Mark Faraday, science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. Good morning.
Good morning.
And it hasn't really felt much like spring, but the sounds are there. We have the drumming woodpeckers, blackbirds, woodcocks displaying.
Yeah, that's a good mix. Yeah. It's a good mix, Dan. This is the kind of stuff people should be hearing outside right now. These are the birds that don't migrate. They're here year round, but they're feeling the increasing day length. They're feeling it in their hormones and
getting
singing
up early.
More. And you know, the cavity nesters are peering into cavities more often. If you watch the birds in your yard, things like titmice and chickadees are scoping out nest boxes and holes in trees and kind of thinking about where they want to put their nest. Bluebirds are doing the same. Mm-hmm. And so these birds that stick around, they know it's spring. I mean, even though it's, you know, bird bath is still frozen in the morning and it snowed the other day. It's a little ridiculous.
Crazy.
But they know it's coming. Birds have faith.
Yeah. And we're seeing some April migrants, right? Got the phoebes and kestrels. And what else is coming in?
We do see April migrants in April. It's funny how that works.
Yeah. They know. It doesn't matter if it's not warm. They know it's April.
Yeah. And it's crazy to think that typically the first hummingbirds turn up in April. I have, and I know that, and I usually have my hummingbird feeder out by April 15th, which is, you know, it's ambitious, but it's not out of the question.
Because when they first get here, there's not a whole lot for them to you know, there's not a lot of flowers in bloom right now.
Right. I don't understand. I mean, hummingbirds are amazing. The places where I've seen them where it's cold and there don't seem to be any flowers, and they can do it somehow. And so you look at the weather we've had and think about that, you know, in less than a week, we could possibly get the first couple of hummingbirds. I mean, just it seems absurd, but that's true. I tell people mid-April for putting out your hummingbird feeder, but a lot of people, they're like, well, yeah, I did that, and I didn't see it until May, and sometimes that happens. Mm-hmm. Depends
but
on your
chance,
neighborhood.
Right?
But
just,
yeah, it's worth it. You could get one.
Yeah, and even if you've never done it before, they could find it. Right?
Right.
Yeah. Do the same hummingbirds come back to your yard? I always wonder that. You know, I have hummingbirds every year, but are they the same ones or are they new? I guess there's no way of really telling, is there?
Yeah, I don't. I would guess it's the same ones for a couple of years. They're not a bird that lives more than, you know, mm-hmm. 5 years or something like that. So there's certainly turnover. But yeah, I would guess if a female was successful nesting in your neighborhood that, you know, if she's alive that next mm-hmm. year, then you might see that same female. But there's a lot of coming and going. If you were to trap every hummingbird at your hummingbird feeder, you would find that you thought there were like a couple that were just coming over and over. But in reality, there are like probably six or seven or more that come and go, and they come from all different parts of the area. But I would guess yes. But there's a lot of turnover too.
866-999-4626 is our number for your bird stories, comments, or questions this morning. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, so we have lots of little birds and big birds thinking about this. I saw two osprey on two of the poles on Surf Drive.
Yeah, ospreys are back. I mean, the first scouts generally come back around St. Patrick's Day, but it was very slow this year. They were slow to come back. And, you know, again, it gets back to this weather. You know, a lot of them are coming back from Venezuela. When they're leaving Venezuela, they don't know that we're still getting snowstorms here. So they kind of have to take their chances. But once they, get to the U.S., then I think they can kind of hedge their bets and stay south if they feel it's not right. But definitely some came back and just had to weather those storms. Mm-hmm. By the time you get to mid-April, the nests are pretty well occupied, and they're sprucing them up. And
it was a tough winter for those nests.
It was a tough winter, and that's another thing I wanted to talk about, because a lot of the poles got damaged. Not the nests themselves. You know, if nests get damaged, meaning the structures the ospreys themselves built, then you know they can rebuild that in a matter of days. They're pretty amazing in that regard. But the poles, you know, we're getting a lot of calls about poles that are down or leaning and this and that. And we have pretty limited capacity at Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary to go out and do, you know, we don't have like a osprey construction crew sitting in it. We've got a lot of stuff going on. And I don't know who built the vast majority of the poles all around the Cape, especially down this end where there are so many poles and so many ospreys. And so I'm always interested in, you know, who who put up these poles? Who do people use to repair them? You know, I usually direct people to call their conservation agent in the town and kind of start there, you know, because maybe they know who's been putting up and repairing poles. A lot of people just contract privately with somebody. But there's going to be, I think there's a lot of work to do this year, but it's getting to be too late because soon they'll have eggs and then you can't really do anything. We had one in by Skakit Beach in Orleans that we wanted to fix. It was really leaning over and the struts were gone. But the birds kind of got ahead of us and had built a new kind of more upright nest. They just sort of account for the tilt and they, you know, build a nest straight up and go from there. There are a lot of nests that are way tilted over that the have sort of stabilized and the birds just nest on them like that and they're fine with it. But others will need to repair probably next year.
So with the number of osprey that we have, you know, and I know they like to return to the nest that they had last year. What about the new, the younger ones? How, do they just try to find something? I mean, there's only so many poles, right?
Right.
So where do they,
it's
where
tough.
Do they go?
So the so an osprey, the osprey life cycle the first couple of years is the chicks fledge, they migrate south just like the adults. They go to, you know, say Venezuela, Brazil. And when the adults come back, like now the adults have come back. But last year's osprey chicks are all still in South America, right? They don't come back. Terns do the same thing. Young terns are still in the southern hemisphere. So next year they'll come back. And so this year, any young ospreys that are coming back are at least 2 years old. And so then, usually their first year back, they're not very adept at nesting. So they'll if they're lucky, they'll secure a spot somewhere, and then they'll do what's called a play nest. And we've talked about this a number of times. And so when you see ospreys that are initiating a nest kind of late in the season, and they're just sort of, it doesn't look like a very good nest, and it's definitely too late for them to nest successfully, that's a young pair. And so if they can continue to defend that spot, look for them to have a real nest possibly the next year. And so it could take them a few years. But because there are so many adults now and our population is so dense, it's a real success story. I mean, this is great news. There's so many ospreys. Mm-hmm. In the 70s, there was like one pair.
Yeah.
It's a huge success story, and we should pat ourselves on the back for it. It, you know, gets back to banning DDT and putting up nesting poles and you know, bringing some birds up from New York back in the day. And
just shows what you can do.
We
right?
have brought ospreys back, and now there are so many that it's tough for young birds. But that's how population dynamics work in wildlife populations. You get to carrying capacity, and it becomes difficult for young to secure nesting territories, and that's just how it works.
Yeah. Well, so will the territories then spread out a little more, or?
They'll have to either colonize areas that might have been considered marginal, like they're not close to good fishing grounds, or they're too close to nesting great horned owls or something like that. So there's different ways that an area can be kind of marginal for an osprey to nest. It's the site is not very tall, you know, it's not tall relative to the trees around it. And so maybe they're starting to occupy some of these sites, or it's, you know, dangerous in other ways.
Yeah.
And so that's how it works. The experienced adults get the good territories, and this is true of whether you're a bear or a squirrel or, you know, or an osprey. It's just how it works.
All right. Harry's giving us a call from West Tisbury. Good morning, Harry.
Good morning. Just a quick thing on the hummingbirds. You said something, Lindy, you said something about how do you know if it's the same birds coming back. I've had a hummingbird for 10 years in the same spot outside my window. And oftentimes I'm sailing up from the south in April, and I don't get here until that first week of May. And a lot of times I'll get home, and the first thing I see is a ruby-throated hummingbird hovering right where my feeder is every year. And I know it's the same bird. So they're coming back to my feeder every year. I put it in the same place, and they'll sit there for days waiting for me to put it out.
Yeah.
I freak out because I'm like, oh, my God, the hummingbirds are here. And I run around trying to
get on that.
They're waiting. Come on. Yeah, come on, Harry, get us some food.
I will. Because I'm not sailing, so I'll put it out as soon as I can.
Great.
And the other thing I was going to say about the ospreys is we had one show up right before the last nor'easter and find his plumage damaged.
Oh, boy.
I live in Chilmark, and I worried that he wouldn't make it, but he made it and nested on the pole anyway. So.
Yeah, they're tough. Yeah, they're tough.
Yeah, they're tougher than you would think.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Harry.
Anyway, thanks, guys.
I'll look for my returning hummingbirds.
Yeah.
We should mention there's some good news when we're talking about osprey, about transmitters. There was a lost transmitter that was found, those little satellite things they put on the...
Right. So this happened the other day, and So at Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary, we have our stalwart, long-serving Hawk Watch volunteer, Don Manchester. He lives in Sandwich, and he drives up to Truro, to the High Head area of Truro, Pilgrim Heights, and he does a spring hawk watch there. And he's already started going up on days with favorable winds. But he gets around, and he loves raptors, and he's the first person I talk to if I want to know what's going on with the peregrine falcons nesting on the bridges and that kind of thing. So he was in Mashpee, I think, part of the Mashpee River, and he saw an osprey fishing there, and there were a bunch of ospreys there, and he saw this one that had a satellite transmitter on it. And any osprey with a satellite transmitter around here, that transmitter was put on it by Rob Beauregard, a longtime osprey researcher with strong ties to the vineyard. He was a big part of studying that vineyard population as it recovered, working with Gus Ben-David over there over the years. And he has studied ospreys for many years, and he's been the primary person in the Northeast who's been studying their migration with these satellite transmitters. And so I emailed Rob, and I haven't seen the pictures yet, but I said, Don Manchester got the photos of this osprey with a transmitter. Do you know who it might be? And he's like, OMG, that's going to be Bell. And so Bell is an osprey that, he lost track of. The transmitters only transmit for so long.
Right.
But the transmitter is still on the bird, apparently. And he just wrote a book about this bird. It's a kid's book, and it's coming out soon. So he's getting like a free book promotion here thanks to this bird. I don't know.
Nice timing, right?
Yeah. What are the odds? It's called Bell's Journey, An Osprey Takes Flight. I think it's coming out maybe next month, I think he said, and it's a children's book. And it's about this very osprey. And so it was sort of fortuitous. What I want is I want people to figure out where this bird is nesting because, it's hard to, if it's fishing, and it's hard to photograph it and really nail down that it's definitely Bell. But if we know where the nest is, then we could go in there and Rob could go in and maybe confirm that it is indeed her. And so people in the Mashpee area, there are a lot of osprey nests in that area, certainly associated with the Mashpee River and just really everywhere in that town. So if anybody, look closely at your nesting osprey, and if you see your bird has a little bit of an antenna sticking off the back, let me know. Mm-hmm. And, I'll contact Rob and we can get that figured out. and that leads me to the other cool thing that's happened in Mashpee recently.
Yeah, Mashpee's the hot spot, I guess.
Apparently, yeah. For raptors, we've talked innumerable times about bald eagles and when are we going to find the first bald eagle nest on Cape Cod for, at least since 1905 or whenever the last one was. And somebody recently photographed a bald eagle, an adult bald eagle at Mashpee Wakeby Pond, which is the place we've been expecting there to be a nest for a long time, carrying nesting material a few weeks
ago.
That's
exciting.
Yeah, it was very exciting. And I forwarded that to the Mass Wildlife folks. They were excited. And they followed up the bald eagle survey. The statewide bald eagle survey was last Friday.
Oh.
They try to cover as much of the state as possible. And so somebody went up in an Apache helicopter from the base trying to find. So based on this intelligence, they got into a military-style helicopter and went up and tried to find that nest, and they couldn't. So I don't know what it is about these Cape Cod bald eagles, but they just do not want us to find their nests.
Maybe can't we say just, I blame them.
Maybe we should just leave them alone. I mean, yeah. I just want to know about it.
Yeah.
you don't want people going there and harassing them with right. photographers, and there's issues. Usually they're in inaccessible places where they kind of have a natural buffer. Like this one in Plymouth that I go to, it's on an island. We be very difficult to get to, and so they're pretty isolated. But
aren't they usually up pretty high too?
They're up high, and the nests are surprisingly well hidden. Oftentimes, they tend to nest in trees with leaves, usually pines. A big white pine, a really big old pitch pine, something like that, and it'll be pretty well hidden in there. For a gigantic nest that weighs thousands of pounds, you can't believe they could hide a nest, but
right.
but they can. So you look for the birds. I mean, you look for that white head, which shows up at a great distance, and they'll often just sit right next to the nest for long periods.
Mm.
And so when you see a bald eagle this time of year, an adult bald eagle, it should have a nest,
right?
Because otherwise it would have moved on, you know, because this is the time of year when they're nesting. So if you see one, you see it perched somewhere, check the pines, check the pine it's sitting in or whatever, you know, just look all around where that bird is and see if you can find a nest structure. You might be surprised. You could be the one. Mm-hmm. You could be the one that finally confirms where the nest site is.
You're giving homework assignments to folks in Mashpee.
Yeah. I need people to do my work.
John's calling from Orleans. Hi, John.
Hi. A guy was spraying for ticks next door. He didn't say what chemicals he's using. He said when it's dry, it's not toxic. I don't know if that impacts birds in any way. Do you?
Yeah. So this has been a big thing lately. These companies are really promoting this spraying for ticks, and some of the public health folks promote it too. And it's up to people what they want to do in their yards. I would encourage people not to do it, but take other precautions. They're using some kind of pyrethroid, I would guess. And what they say, they're safe because as long as bees and things aren't flying while you're spraying it, once it dries on the foliage, it's not toxic. There are worse things you can use. It's like with all chemicals, there are worse ones and better ones, and these aren't as bad as some. But I would encourage people to look into other options and don't necessarily just buy into the sales pitch of someone coming around offering tick spraying. And,
it doesn't last. I mean, you could spray that and, get rid of maybe the ticks that are right there right now, but they're going to come back.
Yeah. I worry more about the other beneficial insects than I do the birds.
Yeah.
It's something you'd want to be really use pretty sparingly.
Yeah. John, thanks for the phone call. 866-999-4626 is our number for your birds' comments, questions, or stories. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after break. You're listening to The Point, and we are talking about birds this morning with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. We welcome your comments, questions, or stories. And if you want to talk about some other critters, we'll talk about them too. 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We have an email from Mike who says, speaking of osprey, living here in Woods Hole is Dr. George Woodwell. He, of course, founded the Woods Hole Research Center here, but many don't realize that it was his research work and testimony, along with some colleagues, that led to DDT being banned in 1972, an environmental hero in our neighborhood. Thanks, Mike, for reminding us of that.
Yeah, very cool.
Yeah. All right. So we're talking about the ticks and, the spraying of them and what that might do to some of the beneficial bugs and the pollinators. So let's talk a little bit. This is about the time of year where people start, getting into the gardens and cleaning up. We're going to have Roberta Clark in next week. We'll start back with our gardening segments.
Yep.
But we want to attract the birds and pollinators to our yards, and it's not really all that hard to do.
No. There are a lot of great things that you can plant in your yards, things that are locally available, or you can order online for some of the nurseries that specialize in native plants, like North Creek or Prairie Moon is a good one to research plants. The New England Wildflower Society, their Garden of the Woods in Framingham, and their website, and they have a new, a really cool new site. For searching out native plants you can plant in your yard, and you can click off all these different criteria, like I want a pollinator powerhouse or one that attracts butterflies or one that attracts hummingbirds that will grow in shade and dry soil. And so you click these different things, and it brings up a list of native plants that you can try in that spot. So it really does the work for you if you have a difficult yard. I have too much more shade than I would like. Mm-hmm. And, you want full sun for most kind of gardening for pollinators. But there are lots of shade plants that you can try. And so look for that New England Wildflower site for finding plants. But so at the sanctuary, at Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary, we're completely redoing our pollinator garden. Mm-hmm. And, it had kind of gotten away from us for a couple of years and got sort of weedy and whatever. So we basically have nuked it.
Just so, pulled everything out.
Almost everything, except mm-hmm. for some, you know, older woody things that are nice that I like in there, like an Abelia and a Vitex and butterfly bush. None of those are native, I don't think, but they're not invasive.
They're not invasive here,
or, you know, butterfly bush can be a little bit aggressive on the Cape, I've heard from some people, but this particular one I've never seen put up a seedling, and it if it behaves itself, it's a very good plant. So I've been, you know, I've been observing our garden for years, and I do my own kind of pollinator gardening, and so I've put together this list, I've been obsessing over it, of plants, and we're going to, you know, bring in new soil and just kind of start from scratch. Mm. And there's so many good plants out there that, like I said, you can get at the local nurseries, and if not, you can order seeds if you, you know, want to take a longer-term strategy. And there's some great shrubs. When it comes to feeding birds in the winter, I would definitely have some winterberry. My winterberry was very popular this year, and it got skeletonized. It was attracting bluebirds for a while, kind of on and off, and then the horde of robins found it, right? And then they were gone. And I just have one little, I don't have a big yard. I just have this one little winterberry. But you can clump them. You can have a bunch of winterberry, cedar, encourage red cedar, which is just kind of, cedar just happens. You don't typically buy a cedar and plant it in your yard. They're just sort of everywhere. And you probably already have them in the neighborhood. But fruiting cedars is a real powerhouse for attracting birds and feeding them in the winter. My neighbor's big red cedar was laden with fruit just across the street from my front yard, and that was kind of bringing in the birds, I think. Yeah. And from there, they would come over and visit my winterberry and some other winterberries. I also have chokeberry. Mm-hmm. That's another one. Aronia is the genus, and that's a native wetland shrub around here that it doesn't need tons of water. It's just it can be a good landscape plant. You could even do crab apples, you know, zoomy crab apples are really good. Crab apple, if you want a nice kind of ornamental tree in your...
They're beautiful in the spring when they
They're flowering, and they attract, you know, things like the first orioles coming in are often in flowering crab apples and apples and things like that.
Yeah, I see them in my apple
cherries.
Trees. Yeah.
And then when they fruit, those fruits persist throughout the winter and attract things like waxwings and robins and things like that. So there's lots of a lot of these plants, like winterberries and hollies, they feed birds in the winter with their fruit. But in the spring, when they're flowering, they have these little flowers that nobody would think much of, but they're incredibly attractive to pollinators. Mm. I mean, you if you come upon a holly that's in flower in the spring, stop and look and listen. I mean, it is going to be full of all kinds of native bees.
Yeah.
It's amazing. And so you get kind of double value from some of these landscape plants.
Yeah,
even inkberry, kind of a common native landscape plant that you put around borders or in front of buildings and things. There is some ink. I've never thought much of it. You know, it's got these little fruits. I've never seen things eating it very much.
Yeah, little white flowers, yeah.
Right. It's a holly. It's another holly. Mm-hmm. But in front of the Salt Pond Visitor Center in Eastham, the Cape Cod National Seashore, they have this line of inkberries, and you'll see bluebirds hitting those.
It's
because it's adjacent to that big field, that grassy little blue stem field there. And so, you know, under the right circumstances, inkberry can be very good. It's native, and it produces fruits that could bring in bluebirds. So look into all these different native shrubs.
And I think Roberta returns next Tuesday, and we'll talk more, obviously, about gardening when Roberta's here. Look at this lovely picture of this woodpecker that Joe sent us. But Joe is in Rhode Island. It says Northern Rhode Island here because we don't see these.
I know. I get excited when I see a picture of a pileated woodpecker because we're still waiting for that smoking gun. You hear whispers of people saying they've seen a pileated on Cape Cod, but it's never substantiated. It's like our version of the ivory-billed woodpecker, right? We just don't have them. Our woods are not old enough. I mean, there are parts of the Cape where there are big, beautiful old trees that I think could support pileated woodpeckers. They just haven't gotten here.
Yeah. And, you know, I would think, too, at the sanctuary, you don't take down those rotten trees as they fall. They stay.
Yeah.
So, I mean...
Dead trees are really important for wildlife. I mean, even in my yard, I would like to... Most people would be like, oh, my God,
get rid of that tree, yeah.
I really encourage people to leave at least some snags, as long as it's... And I think people tend to overestimate the danger of a snag. Mm-hmm. And a snag is a forestry term for just a dead tree. And often you get these old ones that nothing's left but the trunk, mm-hmm. the branches have long since fallen off. Those are pretty stable. Those don't fall over. They don't offer a lot of wind resistance. The trees that fall over are live trees, right? You look at what happened during those storms. It wasn't dead trees falling over. The dead trees are pretty aerodynamic, right? But it's live pines are the most likely trees to fall over. And so I think people are like, oh, the dead trees, got to take them down. You know, big branches fall off of living oaks. But the dead trees can be surprisingly stable, and they provide a lot of habitat for a lot of wildlife, not just birds, but bats and mice and everything. They're really, really important features of the landscape when it comes to wildlife.
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, I have a question for you here about ducks. I see people feeding the ducks a lot, and there's this people say you shouldn't feed the ducks. It's okay to feed the ducks, and then it's is bread okay? It's not okay. People say don't feed the ducks bread. You should feed them, you know, seeds or other grapes. I even heard. What do ducks like? And is it okay to feed them bread?
Ducks like gluten-free, soy-based. No, I mean, ducks want anything you can feed
anything
them.
You can
ducks
feed.
Don't care.
Like gulls.
Right. The thing about, and they'll be fine, the thing about feeding the ducks is more about protecting the water quality of that water body. When you see these don't feed the ducks things, it's because, you know, oftentimes a pond where you're feeding ducks is sort of a public pond, and it's probably got other issues. It's got too many nutrients as it is. And then people are coming and throwing entire loaves of bread in there, and that's attracting ducks, and the ducks are pooping more. And, and it just, you know, we have a lot of nutrient issues in our various bodies of water here on the Cape, which cause environmental damage. And so adding more nutrients and unnaturally concentrating ducks by throwing Wonder Bread out to them, it's just not good for water quality. And as far as the impact on the ducks, I don't know. Too much high glycemic index carbs and they're going to get diabetes. I don't know. It's really more about the water quality than it is about the ducks.
Yeah. But, you know, and you see, I don't know if you've ever noticed it on Surf Drive over in the parking lot there by the beach. Somebody goes out there and there's a load of ducks and gulls there every single day. And it's almost like they're just waiting for this person to come back and feed them.
Yeah. And the state does a nesting duck census I take part in. There's a guy named H. Hoisman, who's been a duck biologist with Mass Wildlife for a million years, and he still sends out these paper forms. But the state is also interested in duck feeding areas like that. And I saw one of those in Plymouth recently. I was doing a Christmas bird count there by Long Pond in Plymouth, and this couple came in the wee hours. It's, like, still dark. And they came in and just, like, dumped a whole bag of, like, feed, like livestock feed. They just came from the grain store or something.
Yeah,
just
that's kind of like what this is too. Yeah, right in the parking lot.
It's just not good. I mean, they don't need that. And then they just left, you know, like the ducks don't need you to do that. These are wild animals. You know, and it was just so much feed. And they certainly appreciate it. I mean, the blue jays were coming in all of a sudden and the cardinals and, you know, the duck lobby is very much for feeding the ducks. They're a very powerful lobby.
You know, I guess it's hard too in the wintertime when it's so cold and they look like they're just freezing there. It's tempting to want to go and give them a little something.
I know,
eat.
And we all feed the birds in our yards. And where do you draw the line? But it's a little extreme to buy a giant bag of seed and just dump it on the banks
That's
of a
true.
Nice pond.
Yeah. Although I will say, the reason I was asking you too about attracting birds to your yard with plants is because I've had to stop feeding my birds because I got rats.
Yeah, your rat infested yard.
Yeah, not
you're
anymore,
pariah.
but I don't want to bring those rats back either. You know?
I know.
And so it's tough, and I really miss having my little bird feeder right outside the window, but I still have the birds because they're coming into my yard.
Yes.
I have lots of blue jays in my, you know, evergreens. And,
right. Yeah. I've been surprised. I've had to do the same thing. I've had an individual rat that will take up residence under my deck. My dog Timmy will alert me to its presence. Well, I'll take him out at night, and he's like chasing something under the deck, and it dives under the kayak, you know. And I'm like, all right, got to stop feeding the birds back here for a little while. And I kept feeding the birds in the front, but the rat seems to have moved on. But just stop feeding for a while, then you can, you know, try starting up again. But like you're saying, you'd be surprised. It depends on your yard, you know, and where you live. But if you have, you know, trees and a, you know, natural border and there's some habitat in your surrounding neighborhood, you'd be amazed at how many birds you still get.
Right. You just can't look for them in that one spot anymore. You have to kind of look through the whole yard.
That mixed flock that in your neighborhood with the chickadees and the nuthatches and the titmice and the jays and everything will still come through, probably. Mm-hmm. It just, you know, might not stay as long, or, you know, they're not going to, you know, the goldfinches aren't going to sit on your feeder half the day, or, you know. Yeah. But the birds will still be around and they'll still come through. You'll be surprised.
Yeah, and I wonder where those rats are living. And I wonder if it's, you know, they put in the sewers.
They're in your room.
Yeah, no, they put the sewer in through, you know, so I'm sure they disrupted wherever they were. But the rat expert said they're not living in your yard. You're on their path. And I was like, wow, I thought if they were there, that
you're,
would you...
You're on their commute.
Yes, I'm on their commute. So
you're
we
just
have
like
to discourage them.
You're the Dunkin' Donuts on their on
yes.
their commute.
Go find another branch.
Yeah.
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. Love to hear your bird comment, questions, or stories, or other critters living here on the Cape and Islands. 866-999-4626. 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Dan sent us a picture wondering what he saw sitting up on the wires at the end of Oyster Pond Road in Falmouth. And it is
It's an osprey.
Osprey. Yeah. So, Dan, it's an osprey you're looking at. And then Pete Trimble sent us a note to remind you that...
Yeah. Peter's been around. I always forget about this before my time. There was a pileated woodpecker on Great Island there in Yarmouth, that kind of private, gated, weird little island that the public can't get to. But what was it? It was there for a year?
It says about a year. About 1 year on Great Island.
Interesting. Yeah. It's just a bird We just don't have them.
So it's there for about a year going, where are all my friends?
Yeah.
Gotta go. Yeah.
Right. And eventually we will have them, I think, as the forests get older. They're in Plymouth County, not very commonly, but they are. I've had them in Lakeville. They're in Hingham, places like that. That's about as close as they get right now. And they're south of us. I mean, they're certainly, you know, really common in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
I would guess that most people get their pileated woodpeckers either when they go to northern New England in the summer or when they go to Florida in the winter.
Right.
They can be common both places, and that's where people generally see their pileated woodpeckers. And they're such a cool bird.
They're beautiful, yeah.
Flaming, crested, crow-sized beast of a woodpecker. It's like, boy, if that ever took an interest in your cedar shingles, you'd have to sell the house.
Oh, my goodness, yeah. So this is the time of year, too, where we see a lot of that drumming where the woodpeckers are going, this is my territory, where are you, my love?
Right, right, right. Listen for those drums from, there's the whinny of a downy woodpecker. So that's a downy. Hairy would sound a little different. It would be all on one pitch.
Yeah, here
so there's
we go.
The drum. There's the drumming, the territorial drumming of a downy woodpecker.
My goodness.
That's a red-bellied woodpecker. Dan's quizzing me.
Yeah, right. And you're getting all your questions correctly answered.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, let's talk to Janet, who's calling from West Tisbury. Hi, Janet.
I'm calling about my chickadees.
Mm-hmm.
They're very friendly birds. Every time I go out to feed my horse in the morning, they practically mob me. They fly through my hair.
Oh, my.
They know I have food for them. Does anybody ever have any experiences like that besides me? There's about 8 of them.
Yeah, everybody that goes to the beach forest in Provincetown. So this is the beach forest, B-E-E-C-H. It's a part of the Cape Cod National Seashore that's a place you should be thinking about right now. It's very much a spring hotspot for migrants, but it's been well known for many years. People have trained, some of the locals trained the chickadees to eat out of their hands. And
yeah,
so
I've done that too.
Yeah, you don't even need food. You know, they just follow you around, and it's the nuthatches and the titmice too, and they'll just land on your hat, or if you stand there with your hand out, they'll land on it. Even if you don't have food.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad it's not just me.
Janet, will you say they're coming through? Are they trying to pull out your hair? I've seen them do that with the dog sometimes.
No, they just fly around. They just fly around, touch my hair. They don't actually land on my hair, but they fly through the hair.
Yeah.
Sometimes I've seen them pull like some of the dog hair out, you know, and like take it to the nest.
Yeah. I don't have that. I don't know if you've met me, but I don't have that problem.
I don't have
a lot of hair for the chickadees to fly through.
Last year, I found a nest. I have a horse. And some bird, a small, very small bird, made a nest and took several pieces of his tail hair and wound it into the most beautiful nest you could believe.
Wow.
Oh, yeah.
It must have been a chickadee or something smaller.
Or titmice. Titmice are also famous for that. There's a lot of pictures out there of them just sitting on someone's golden retriever.
Right, yeah.
Golden retriever's kind of lying on the deck, like whatever.
Not moving,
and the
yeah.
titmice, they're pulling hair out of them. And they love animal hair. So,
yeah.
you know, some people will offer them the combings of their pets. You know, you groom your pet and you left
yeah.
them with that. What do you do with that big ball of hair? Just throw it out in the yard and
the birds will
it'll end
it.
Up in yeah. the local bird nest. Yeah. yeah.
Jenna,
well,
thanks.
My horse is shedding right now, so there's oh. tons of hair, and I just leave yeah. it on the ground and it disappears.
Yeah, the birds take it.
I also have a lot of crows, and mm-hmm. I actually can call them, and they will come.
They're very smart, those crows.
Oh, yeah. yeah.
I know. I feed them bread or whatever. And I also have a squirrel, which I can hand feed. It comes
wow.
to the window, and it will eat. And I did, a couple of years ago, I had a skunk that did that. It would eat out of my hand.
You're brave.
And in the morning, I would find it on the steps waiting.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, geez.
Yeah.
Geez, Janet. Animal control is on the way to shut you down. I don't encourage people to yeah. feed crows. They yeah. don't need it, and there's too many of them.
Yeah. Janet, thanks
well,
for calling.
Well, I kind of bribe them, because if I don't do it, they'll steal the suet.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
You know, I right. have to remember to bring it in at night, because the whole thing is gone in the morning if I forget.
What a racket you've got going there.
All right, Janet, thanks for the call. Let's move on to Irma, who's calling from East Falmouth. Hi, Irma.
Good morning, Mindy. Keep your rat down your end of Davisville Road, please.
I'm sorry?
You can keep your mouse or
oh,
your rat.
Oh, yeah. yeah.
I've been noticing black squirrels this year, and I have only known black squirrels in Canada,
mm-hmm.
and there are several in my yard, and I've never seen them before.
Yeah. Oh, interesting.
Yeah. I've been seeing them for years, yeah.
Oh, have you?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, it's a kind of a genetic, it's a version of the eastern gray squirrel. They're just eastern gray squirrels. It's a color morph that tends to occur in certain areas. And like you said, southern Canada is one of the places, parts of Connecticut I've seen them. And then you're saying
come to my neighborhood.
Falmouth
yeah.
is one
yeah.
of them too.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's good
sure,
to know, but
right. They're all over our neighborhood.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a melanistic, or it's just a color form of the eastern gray squirrel, but it's kind of interesting. I've seen them in Minnesota. They just occur in these little pockets, but not generally.
Yeah. All right, Irma, thanks thanks for that phone call. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, so you found this interesting study about a great mystery of bird migration, and so how they may be navigating by, they see the Earth's magnetic field? What's
yeah.
this about?
Can't you see it?
Yeah, I wish. No.
You have to look with your heart. Yeah. No, so bird migration is obviously, it's always been one of the great mysteries in science and nature, and people have wondered about it for forever. And when you think about it, you know, these birds that are hatching out of nests during the summer, there's young birds and the adults alike, they have to then find their way to, in some cases, Central and South America, places, in the case of the young birds, they've never been to. And without the help of their parents, aren't like, you know, booking a flight and taking them. They have to find their own way. And the shorebirds that have to get from above the Arctic Circle to southern South America, young ones where the adults have left them a month ago, and so they're on their own. How do they do that? I couldn't do that. You couldn't do that.
No.
You know, so obviously there's some cues they're using, or you can't just say, well, they're born that way. They, you know, there's some mechanism there. And so people have been studying this. And so some molecular biologists have been really digging into this and getting at this idea that birds can sense, and we've been sort of aware of this as a possibility, that birds can sense the Earth's magnetic field somehow. So, you know, different parts of the Earth have different shapes of the magnetic field, that if you did have some mechanism, you could detect it and then know which way you were facing based on the Earth's magnetic field, right? We use compasses, but birds would have to have some kind of internal mechanism. And so these molecular biologists were looking at these proteins in the eyes, and they found that these certain proteins that are usually involved in regulating their daily rhythms, the circadian rhythms, but they found these ones that most likely are, or it's tantalizingly likely that they could allow them to see the magnetic field. And if you look this up, there was some kind of artist rendering of what that might look like as they look at the horizon, and there are kind of different shapes to this sort of magnetic haze potentially. Based on whether you're looking north or west or east, it has sort of a different shape to a bird's eyes. We already know that, you know, we can't know what birds see through their eyes. We already know they see the ultraviolet spectrum, which we can't.
Mm-hmm.
And so that means, so you look at a blue jay, can you tell a male from a female blue jay?
No, only a blue jay can.
Only a blue jay can, and it's because of the ultraviolet spectrum. So they look very different to the birds than they do to us. And so here's another way that they're just sensing the environment in a way we can't even imagine. And so they can kind of orient themselves. This isn't, you know, certain proof. This is just kind of more strong evidence and a nice new lead in this question of how birds migrate using the Earth's magnetic field. And this is one of the things they use. Birds migrating at night can use the stars. That's been shown. Mm-hmm. There's some experiments with captive birds and changing the orientation of the stars overhead.
Mm-hmm.
As you rotate the artificial night sky overhead, they will change the direction. They will always keep heading towards south, as indicated by the stars. So that's been shown experimentally a long time ago. But so they kind of have a bag of tricks for orienting themselves and getting from one end of the earth to the other.
I thought this was interesting. This gene expression of three cryptochromes and this one called CRY4. And the most interesting thing in that article I found was that the European, there were two different sets of birds that they used, but the European robins increased their CRY4 expression during the migratory season compared to the non-migratory chickens.
Yes.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. So that was another strong piece of evidence there that this particular cryptochrome is involved in seeing the magnetic field because, there's a suite of things that happen physiologically to birds driven by hormones that prepare them for migration. Long-distance migrants, their kind of digestive systems will shrink. They'll change the way they put on fat. They'll put on tons of fat all of a sudden. And so this is probably just another one of those kind of hormonally regulated physiological changes that prepares a bird for migration. Like, okay, now I can see the magnetic field better.
All right. Eric just sent us an email. I live in Fairhaven where I noticed the big nest of turkey vultures living on the roof of an abandoned building by the bike path by Old Rogers School. Can you talk real quick about them?
Yeah. Well, not a nest, but it sounds like a roost.
Mm-hmm.
But abandoned building is the kind of place they might nest. So you might want to check that abandoned building in May and June. Turkey vulture is a very scarce and surprisingly cryptic local breeder, kind of like the bald eagles. Like, we're pretty sure they're nesting here, but turkey vultures do nest on the Cape. All the nests I've heard of have been out closer to me, out in the Outer Cape, and they've all been in abandoned buildings. Creepy little abandoned sheds in the woods just off Route 6 in Wellfleet. That was one last year. I went and saw the chicks. People called it in. There was this one chick. Boy, they're creepy.
Yeah, they look like prehistoric.
Yeah, yeah. They're very important. They're great birds, and they're important. They have an important role. We see a lot of them as spring migrants, especially. Mm-hmm. They're a very common spring migrant. They start showing up in late February here. There's places they'll overwinter, like the Vineyard and Bourne.
Because I have seen them in Bourne, yeah.
Right. They will overwinter, but not generally across the Cape, just in certain places. And certainly in Bristol County, there are places where they're year-round, and even in the Berkshires.
Yeah.
It depends on where there are farms that, farm animals, that food source for them. But yeah, look for, if you see turkey vultures hanging around in the summer, check out like barn lofts, abandoned buildings, that kind of thing.
So
one was in a basement, the basement of an abandoned building in the National Seashore out there in Wellfleet.
So if he goes and checks out that abandoned building in a month or so, he might see some chicks. Maybe. All right.
Maybe. Yeah, a couple of months.
Let's talk to our pal John from Hyannis Whale Watch. Hi, John.
Hi, good morning, Mark.
Hey, John.
Good morning, Mindy. Hey, just sort of an anecdote from the back deck this morning as I was trying to get the kids headed toward the door for school. I out of the corner of my eye, I saw a mouse run across the edge of the house and disappeared around the corner and said, oh, there's something else to think about. And suddenly the mouse reappeared. It flew up in the bush and it was a little winter wren. And that was, for me, a welcome sign of spring. And we can all use that right about now.
Yeah, yeah.
It's, that's for sure.
It's not a sign of winter. I mean, they're called winter wren for a reason. It's because they show up here in the fall, and winter is when we're most likely to see them. But yeah, we'll also get spring migrants coming through, I suppose. But that's a good description. They're like a little mouse. They're much smaller than the Carolina wren, which is our typical backyard wren that mm-hmm. people should be familiar with, that nests around our houses and spends the winter as well. But winter wren is this little, it barely has a tail. It's just this little nub, and they're adorable. And it's one of my favorite birds, and one of the most beautiful songs in the entire bird world, I think.
I keep hoping that I'll hear it sing today somewhere.
I don't know. Dan's going to try to find one, but just you can look it up online.
I don't think it's on the list,
Dan. Yeah, it's probably not on the list because they don't breed here. The closest place you can find winter wrens breeding is Wampatuck State Park in Hingham.
Oh.
And so listen for them along a stream. There's kind of nice big hemlocky woods and a little gurgling stream. That's what they like. And big trees, upturned root balls. They like to nest in upturned root balls. But we get them in winter, and they're just a charming, tiny little ball of brown fluff. Okay,
good. John, thanks for sharing that. When does the whale watch start up again?
Well, we should have the boat back up to Barnstable Harbor here in the next week. It's down at the shipyard, and we start sailing next weekend, Sunday, weather permitting.
All right.
Good.
We'll look for your updates and what you see out there.
Good to see you at Cape Cod Beer and finally put a face to the name and the voice.
Yeah.
And thanks to everyone else who came out to Cape Cod Beer for the pub night.
Yeah.
That was a good time. Yeah.
Indeed, that was a good time. Well, we'll talk to you next month.
Okay.
We've got something to report from the water.
Great. Thanks, John. Thanks for calling. And then finally this morning, you mentioned that new garden that you're putting together. And so the sanctuary looking for some volunteers to help out with that?
Yeah, yeah. We have a couple volunteers, but we could use some more. It's going to take a lot of work, as you know, starting a garden from scratch with perennials. You know, we're trying to use perennials that don't need too much, like low maintenance native kind of things. But certainly we're going to need a watering schedule and that kind of thing and help with weeding going forward so we can keep this thing really a big attractant for native bees and butterflies and hummingbirds going forward. So anybody out that way who has an interest in gardening,
call the sanctuary,
talk to our volunteer coordinator, Chris, our new volunteer coordinator, and he'll get you on the list.
All right. So, and then this is about the time where we start seeing turtle activity, right? And I was reading something. I can't remember exactly, but if you see a turtle like in the middle of the road, it's good just to pick it up and put it down on maybe the direction's heading.
Exactly.
Don't take it to your neighbor. Don't take it somewhere else. Leave it there.
Don't take it home. And take note of the direction it's facing and just put it on the other side of the road that way, because that's the way it's trying to go anyway. If you put it on the other side, it'll just end up
in the road again.
And so, and another thing that comes up in Wellfleet, we work with diamondback terrapins, and we've been getting some cold stun ones. You know, you think of everybody knows about the sea turtles and the cold stun sea turtle work that we do, but other turtles can get cold stun. The diamondback terrapins, who normally will winter in the mud, it's called brumation. Mm-hmm. It's sort of their version of hibernation, and they'll come out during a warm period or they'll get disturbed from the sediment by something and they'll get cold stunned. And so people will find them and then they'll put them back in the water sometimes, which isn't great. So just call us if you find a terrapin out and about right now. They're starting to think about mating. There's certain places in Wellfleet where they mate, and we're actually starting a study with a graduate student, UMass Amherst, and some professors there, and we're going to be really ramping up our population work with diamondback terrapins in Wellfleet.
So maybe we'll talk a little more about them next month.
Sure.
All right. Mark Verity, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. As always, thank you.
All right.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.